The gap between the super rich and the rest of us is spiralling out of control, with Britain's 1% grabbing more than their counterparts anywhere else in Europe. That top 1% includes some interesting people, and it's changed a bit. Let's find out more on this story and what its effect on us is going to be from Danny Dorling. Good morning, Danny.
Good morning.
Yes, now the top 1%... used to be people, I suppose, of a quite wide spectrum, didn't it?
Well, there's always a 1%, but in the past, when the 1% got far less, they were much more spread out around countries, and it used to include head teachers of large schools and local doctors and so on.
Yes.
That's changed. It's changed in much of Europe, so that increasingly it's financiers and managers, and it's people in the capital city who are in the 1%, and not people spread out across the country. And also the 1% in many places have become far richer. They've taken a greater chunk of the cake. And as they've done that, things like mass unemployment has risen across Europe because there's less money to employ young people if older people, particularly rich older people, are taking more of themselves.
I guess what you're saying in that is then that in the past where it was people like GPs and head teachers, and now it's financiers and managers and accountants, they are paying themselves way more than those people used to. Is that?
Oh, usually more. So in Britain, GPs have actually doubled their salaries in real terms in the last 30 years, but they've actually fallen down the scale. And they partly double their salaries because they're trying to keep up with the people above them. So that costs us more to employ doctors now because they're just trying to get houses in the kind of areas they used to get houses. But you've had this big change. It's very different in different parts of Europe. The European Union monitors the number of financiers who are paid over €1 million euros a year. There are 2,200 of these people in England. And the next highest country is Germany, where there are only 197. So there are huge differences across Europe in what the 1% are taking. In the Netherlands, they take less than 7% of all income, less than half of what they take in the UK. In Switzerland, it's similar as well.
Now, that's very interesting. So what is it about the UK that is making this a lot easier for the super rich to get super rich?
Well, we deregulated more. We followed the American model and we reduced controls on our finance sector, which in the short term allowed them to become much richer, but then of course helped generate the crash. The other thing is that the super rich are attracted by inequality, so the very rich move towards places like London that are becoming more unequal, because these places tend to have pretty low taxes for the very rich, so they don't just increase inequality, they actually are attracted to it, and you get a vicious circle.
Good grief. Now, London, you mentioned there, apparently there are more so-called ultra-high net worth individuals in London than anywhere else on the planet. That's staggering.
Yes, this is per head. I mean, there always will be a place where there are more, but the place where there are most currently is London. So there's an enormous amount of wealth in London. But London also has one of the highest poverty rates in Western Europe in London. These two things go together. Mm. And if you look at average household incomes in England, they're lower than they are in Germany and France. So households on average are better off in those countries which are more equal. Spain is different and trickier because the effect of the crisis has been so much worse in Spain.
Yes. When it comes to London, I'm interested to note that it also includes the largest concentration of Russian millionaires found outside of Moscow.
Yeah, the estimate is about 2,000 millionaire families from Russia living in London at the moment.
I thought they were all in Marbella. So you've
yes. Well, they may have property in Marbella as well. When you get into the ultra high, you know, figures, you're talking people with a spare $30 million to $100 million pounds.
Right.
You have several properties, but it is de rigueur to have a flat in London. And this is a huge problem for London because the super rich are actually using up space that other people would have used up. The population in central London is actually falling. In Kensington and Chelsea, it's going down because when the super rich buy a property, there's only one or two of them. There isn't the kind of people who would have squeezed in before. So it's helping to make the housing crisis in London worse. It's helping to take the average price of a flat or a house in London now over $500,000 and still climbing.
Now, your conclusion is, of course, that this is all not a good thing.
It's not good. It's never been good when this kind of thing has happened anywhere in the world. It tends to lead to a crisis. It creates instability. there is a trickle up of money to the super rich, not a trickle down from them. And countries that control their very riches, that don't let the very rich become incredibly rich, do much better for everybody, probably including the rich. I mean, they won't have as much money, but they'll be safer, there's less crime, there's obviously less fear of kidnap and so on for them, and they can mix with other people in society far easier. They're not so segregated. So if you compare, say, Sweden, and you think about, I don't know, think about ABBA in Sweden.
Yeah.
You know,
they,
ABBA paid an enormous amount of tax for the right to carry on living in Sweden.
Yeah.
But if you compare the lives of those people with, say, American singers who were just as successful, often their lives, this is the lives of the very rich, haven't been as good for the Americans, who've kept more and paid lower taxes, than it has been for Scandinavian superstars. And it's interesting to see that some rich people choose to live in places where they pay higher taxes because they prefer to live in a society with more solidarity.
Interesting. Some of the conclusions you come to are fascinating. One of them is particularly disturbing, that the super rich can view the lower classes as subhuman.
You do begin to get this. We've seen it in studies in America where affluent university students have had their brain scanned, and a series of pictures are shown to them of people. And part of your brain lights up when you see a picture of people.
Yeah.
But when they see a picture of somebody begging or somebody homeless, that part of the brain no longer lights up. They've become used to seeing those people as not people. You see the same thing in India, with the rich in India literally not noticing the beggars on the streets.
Mm.
You know, not because the gap's so big, it's so great. You see it in Europe if you talk to hedge fund managers and so on. They often refer to people as labour, not as people. And it's a horrible thing, but it's almost not the fault of the very rich. It's the fault of the society that they're in and they're helping to create. It's often a way in which people think about their servants. You know, if you begin to think about your servant as very much like you, it becomes hard to treat them as a servant. So it's easier not to look them in the eye, not to think about themselves as somebody who might want to start a family and so on, which, of course, you can't do if you're a servant living in the house of a rich person.
Now, obviously, the government have to take some responsibility for this because they're the ones that set the rate of tax. And surely the obvious thing to reduce wealth inequality is introduce wealth taxes.
Wealth taxes would certainly help. High rates of tax on very high incomes help. So Switzerland has kept its high rate of tax on high incomes, and Germany has, that it's had for the last 30 years. And when you have a high, this is a sort of 60-70% rate of tax on very high incomes, it helps deter people who are otherwise quite greedy from trying to get more because they'll have to pay more in tax. So it doesn't raise you more. But we're going to have more wealth taxes because the wealth inequalities have now become so huge that the only way to begin to reverse these is to look at taxing fixed assets. And in particular for the UK, property. We have some of the lowest property taxes in Europe. The Sultan of Brunei, for instance, you know, is only paying just over £1,000 a year in council tax for his mansion in London, the same as many other Londoners.
Mm.
And this then attracts in more money and results in a housing bubble being created in a place like London. And, you know, it's not impossible that if you continue along this route in London, the very rich get richer, the average gets poorer, then eventually the southeast of England will see the same kind of housing crash that the rest of the periphery of Europe has seen, but an entirely foreseeable one, you know, one that wasn't the result of a, you know, an immediate banking crisis in the States, but one that we're slowly building up to, a bit like the one that happened in Tokyo around about 1990.
Obviously, the coalition government have already reduced the top rate of tax down to 45%, and it plans tougher benefit cuts for the poor. This can't be, again, a good thing.
No, and it partly shows the hold of the 1% over our political parties. I mean, if you look at who's donating money to the parties, a very disproportionate number of Russians are donating to the Conservative Party.
Yes.
The Liberal Party are close, but even Labour, there are very big donors there. All three of our party leaders, partly thanks to their wives earning so much, are well inside the 1%, heading towards the middle of the 1%. So they're very taken away from the rest of the society in a way in which our political leaders were not so divorced in the past. And you get a kind of smug groupthink if you're in that kind of group. So if you are slightly progressive, you think you're very, very progressive.
Mm. Is this, can we blame the current government, or is this something that's been happening way before they got near governing us?
Oh, this has been happening since the very late 1970s onwards, and if you plot the graphs of it, you can't actually see any evidence of changing government. 97 has no effect on it, 2010 has very little effect on these trends, and they've accelerated since the crash. I mean, governments can help and do help, but these are long-term trends. In the past, inequality peaked around 1913 and then reduced decade after decade all the way through the 70s, with numerous different governments of different political views helping that inequality to decrease. So in the 50s, we had Conservative governments in Britain vying to build more council houses than the previous Labour government had managed to do. So these are big changes that you get, and all the three main political parties tend to travel together. But when you get disaffection, which we're getting now in Britain because the average living standards are falling, you get rises for smaller parties. So UKIP is rising, but also the Greens are rising, the National Health Service Party is rising, and not voting is rising.
Has the tipping point then, which must come, already come?
We may be close to it for the United Kingdom. It's possible, and you can see change in sentiment. So the BBC, for instance, has brought its top salaries down. It's paying about half as much for what it calls its talent pool than it was paying about 5 years ago. No banker in Britain is paid what Bob Diamond used to get, and people don't celebrate wealth as much. So it is possible in the United Kingdom we may be near a peak of this. Sadly, worldwide, we're not. Oxfam earlier this year reported that 85 people, the 85 richest multi-billionaires in the world, had the wealth of the bottom half of humanity. And then Forbes magazine updated that a few months later and said it's actually become 67 because the multi-billionaires' wealth is going up faster than the billionaires and faster than the multi-millionaires.
Right.
So worldwide, it looks pretty terrible. But these things always come to an end. They always have come to an end. It requires people to see it as a problem, first of all, before you're likely to begin to tackle it. And I suspect the UK will see a reverse before you begin to see a worldwide reverse in ever-growing inequality. It hasn't always been like this. There are countries of the world where equality is rising. There is no inherent need for it to happen. And when the world was becoming, or people in individual countries were becoming more equal, that is when we brought in health services, when we housed ourselves better, when we had mass schooling for everybody, when university expansion occurred. And one thing I think you can look at to be optimistic in Europe is so many of our children now go to university. Half of young women in Britain go to university. They're all getting university degrees. The idea that these graduates are going to stand for this, basically that the majority of them are going to have to become poor and only a few of them will be winners, I think it's very hard to believe that our young people across Europe are going to put up with it in the same way that young people who grew up in the 1920s and 30s didn't put up with what their parents had accepted before, and they changed the world before.
Fascinating stuff. The book is Inequality and the 1%. Danny Dorling, thanks for coming on. I've actually made up my own acronym. I don't know if you've got this in your book. I've gone for ULNWI, which is Ultra Low Network Individual, which I've decided I'm one of. So
I'm going to start using that one.
Could you? I'll let you have that one for just a 10% finder's fee.
Thank you very much.
Danny, thanks for joining us. All the best.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. TRE.